Hello and welcome to the Nonsense Chronicles. I'm Doug Sashry, and I cannot be joined by anybody else than the one who sets everything up every time is
Rob Mendiola.
Thanks, Rob.
Thanks for the accolades.
Dude, this thing doesn't get put out every week unless you do it.
Well, we make it happen.
That's right.
Yeah. Team effort.
Team effort, man. And nothing.
This is two in a row this week.
That's right.
Lining them up so you can have something ready while you're traveling.
That's right. Because, the guest we have on today, I was traveling that time. So we had to.
Yeah.
It's always good to have stuff in the bank. And today we are talking to Jeff Grunwald of the New Madrid Historical Museum. How you doing, Jeff?
I am doing wonderful, gentlemen. How are you?
Doing good, man. Good. You know, I always have to catch myself and say, don't say Madrid. No, but you pronounce it Madrid, don't you?
New Madrid, like the word Madrid. Mad and rid put together. Yes.
Yeah, not Madrid. Yeah. They say Madrid. Okay.
Right. Yes, so there's seven Madrids in the United States, and actually I believe three of them go by Madrid, depending on what you hear. I've heard. I know the one in Iowa does. So, yeah, you know, it feels like English speakers don't do real well with romance languages, right?
Right.
We got Versailles, Kentucky, and Versailles, Indiana, and Des right. Plains, Illinois. They're kind of all over the place. So, you know, Los Angeles, right? So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Very true. And, today we wanted to have you on because I saw you recently. That was on my bucket list of stopping. It's always been something that I've read about several times over the years since I was a kid. The New Madrid earthquakes of 1811 mm-hmm. and 1812. And a lot of people, I think there's a lot of people out there that don't even know about them. I'm like, really? In the middle of the country? And I'm not talking about, you know, a 4.3 or something like that where, you know, somebody's injected some fluid into the ground and, you know, maybe caused that. No. I'm talking about some serious course changing of river type, you know, earthquake. And
so now we have somebody here to tell us about it.
That's right.
It's nice.
I certainly can. So, yeah, New Madrid, a little town kind of halfway between Memphis and St. Louis, right on the Mississippi River. If you're on I-55, come and see us. We're open every day. But beginning on December 16th, 1811, and running through March of 1812, there were nearly 2,000 earthquakes that occurred. These were recorded by a gentleman named Jared Brooks. He was actually in Louisville, Kentucky. He was an engineer. He used pendulums and springs to track these earthquakes, which I find extremely clever. I love telling that story.
Yeah.
But on December 16th, the thing that started it all off was a massive earthquake occurred in what we now think is extreme northeast Arkansas. Actually, that's where the approximate epicenter for that first quake was. You'll typically see it estimated in the mid to high 7 magnitude range.
That's major.
Now, all these magnitudes we're talking about, too, guys. Richter scale be developed about a century later, so these are just estimates. We're never really going to know how strong these quakes were. But you'll typically see that first one in the mid to high 7. Sometimes you'll see it up into low 8s. I've seen a few people that are kind of downplaying it to high 6s you'll see sometimes. But what you'll probably find are mid to high 7s. There were aftershocks the first day, December 16th. Oftentimes see estimated at about 7. You'll sometimes see one aftershock. You'll other times see 2. So I think that speaks to the imperfect information we're dealing with here. Over the course of those 3 months, you had all these earthquakes. There were other large events that occurred on January 23rd, 1812. That's typically estimated in the mid 7 magnitude range. And then the largest of the quakes caught kind of someone, it was known as the hard shock at the time. That was February 7th, 1812. That one would have occurred closest to New Madrid in what we now call New Madrid County. That January 23rd quake was kind of in between where the December 16th quake occurred on the February 7th one would, so they kind of moved north, it feels like. These earthquakes really leveled the area. So it was really altered the landscape pretty significantly in a lot of ways, impacted population, had a lot of other side effects. But I wonder if you guys have any other questions about that stuff that I've just mentioned right now. Well, I feel like I'm just jabbering.
Well, I know we love to hear it. They at that time in our country, I would assume that, you know, most trade is done on the river, so you'd have a lot of activity, a lot of people living on the river at that time.
Well, New Madrid would have been the largest city in the area. That's why we kind of got naming rights, I guess. Memphis had sort of just been founded, so you really didn't have, and then everything else was further north, right? You had St. Louis, St. Genevieve, St. Charles up there, Kaskaskia, Illinois, but New Madrid was kind of where it was centered. It had been founded in 1789. It was under the aegis of the control of Spain, until it was ceded to France and sold to the U.S. as part of the Louisiana Purchase in 1803.
So that is correct.
That was kind of a quick transaction. Yeah. So the majority of people in the area would have probably been in and around New Madrid. Let's see, I've got the 1810 census numbers, 3165 in the county. And so that's a pretty good number considering we're about the western boundary of the country at that point.
That's true.
The county was much larger than it is now. Understand that too. I think there were about 1500 in New Madrid proper in the town.
Wow. And, now you didn't have the levees that they have now. Correct?
That's exactly right. The levee system actually did not start until 1906, really. It was a private businessman who started that. The town is basically, so we sit on the north bank of the Mississippi River. The river's running east-west here. We're at the top of a big horseshoe bend. It really looks like a cross-section of a light bulb, I guess is the best way to think about it. And we're at the very top of that cross-section. And the town was built up on high ground when it was founded. Almost immediately, that high ground began calving away as the river ate away at the banks. the Spanish built a fort here, Fort Celeste, and it had to be abandoned within 5 years. I think 1795 it was abandoned because its southern wall was about to fall in the river. The present site of New Madrid is about a mile and a half north of where the site was when the town was founded. Basically, it put it almost on the other side of the river at this point, to be honest with you.
Oh, wow.
That the levees really arrested that movement. By the time of the Civil War, it was about a mile north of its original site of its founding. So this bend, you know, has a little more energy to the water there, and it just took it away. And now another thing that really exacerbated that fact is the whole area settled after the earthquakes, about 10 to 15 feet. February 7th, generally regarded as the one I've seen as the main culprit for the area settling. And if you're already losing ground to erosion and then you sink, it's going to go faster. So that just made it worse.
So everything just kind of recompacted and changed the elevation that much.
That's exactly right. You would have had some movement there. Liquefaction, a big problem.
Right.
I don't know if that had anything impacting it, but you had to.
Probably because of the water,
And you've got real the swamps north of us, one of the largest wetlands in America, is the Great Missouri Swamp. They used to call this area Swamp East Missouri because of those swamps. Those were drained around the same time the levee project started.
Yeah, so you're definitely going to get some liquefaction going on.
Yeah.
There are sand blows around here just about everywhere.
Yeah.
Tough to spot, but just about every field has one. So.
Yeah, that's something that...
Yeah, go right ahead.
No, I'm just saying that's something when I went there, I said, you know, when I have a little bit more time next time, I'd love to get with a farmer and see some of that because they were all over the place, you know, but it's also a ton of farmland.
It is, yes. We're kind of in the middle of nowhere. I'm about 23 miles from a stoplight here. So,
wow, nice.
Yeah. Not terrible. We moved here from Memphis. I was in Phoenix before that, so it's kind of a culture shock, but it's been a really great move here. This is my wife's hometown, so we came here in 2012.
So the new Madrid seismic zone, that kind of extends kind of north, northeast and southwest into Arkansas?
Yes, and yes. You've actually got...
And it's currently active as well?
It is, yes. There were 376 earthquakes last year on the
seismic zone. Oh, wow, okay.
Now, only five of them even got to 3 magnitude.
Okay.
3 is kind of the magic number it takes to shake the surface. So all of this is very small. Hang on here. I got a website up here. I've got the USGS. There have been 92 so far this year.
Okay.
Wow.
And no 3 magnitude earthquakes thus far. Usually, like when I started working here about 11 years ago, you could count on about a dozen 3 magnitude quakes a year, and that's down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
There were 5 last year, 6 the year before. I don't really think that means anything. You know, seismicity's been about the same. There's actually 3 main faults that make up the seismic zone here. They start the southern boundary, and they don't have a perfect image of what's going on down there. So there's some folks who think you may have faulting all the way down into Mississippi off the southern end of the seismic zone.
Mm-hmm.
But for our purposes, right, what you generally find is a little town called Marked Tree in northeast Arkansas. It's about 40 miles north of Memphis. That's generally regarded as the southern boundary. Northern boundary going to be just north of Cairo there at the southern tip of Illinois. We pronounce things funny around
here. I know so well.
And so, yeah, there are 2 faults that run basically southwest and northeast.
Kind of parallel with the river,
and
right?
From roughly parallel to the river, that's exactly right. Obviously, jumping up towards Cairo, the northernmost one kind of has an arm into Kentucky as well. So there's your 5th state that has faulting in them. Mm-hmm. I didn't mention Tennessee yet because the 3rd major fault actually starts a little bit west of New Madrid here, and it basically runs like south-southeast, almost straight south, over into Tennessee towards Real Foot Lake. Real Foot Lake is a state park in Tennessee. It actually has a birthday. It was formed by the February 7th, 1812 quake.
Yep.
So those 3, and then there's some smaller ones. I heard a gentleman, head of the Midwest, USGS, talk about what's called the Risco Fault. It kind of starts right at New Madrid and runs straight west. So there's other smaller faults that come off of the main fault.
Yeah, there's a good collection of them throughout the U.S., the lower 48, for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, the reason we have faults here is there's a rift down there. It's called the Real Foot Rift, formed, they think, in conjunction with the Mississippi River Valley.
Mm-hmm.
Some point in the geologic history of Earth, which is now North America, tried to pull in two, which created this low spot in the middle, right? It also left this rift. I call them tectonic scars. I don't know if that's accurate, but that's kind of how I think of them, right?
Well, you got the Ozarks down through there, right?
We're significantly east of the Ozarks.
East, okay.
Actually. Yeah. We're right. Like, we are basically just at the top of the Little Boot Heel there, in Missouri. Yeah. So, like, I'm almost like 20 miles. If I went straight west, I'd be 15 miles north of the Arkansas state line the whole time, or 30 maybe, but, you know, not far. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, they have, Real Foot Lake. I think it's about 4 or 5 feet deep. It's not that deep at all, but it's good fishing area. I have friends in Tennessee that fish there, and that was caused by the sinking, the ground going down, you know, and
There was a creek river ran into the Ohio. It got dammed by a sand blow, which is the source of water for Real Foot Lake today, right? That's why it still has fresh water, why it didn't just disappear. Like, there were a number of lakes that were formed. They're just about all gone now. Real Foot, the main one that's still around. And there was a smaller little pond, is what I think of it, that was there, and the whole area around it settled. You had spill water that came out of the Mississippi that collected into this low ground, and also this source of fresh water from this dammed up creek, river, a little body of water.
Now, what about the, there was tales of, you know, the river running backwards and, you know, waterfalls.
The river running backwards. Yes. So there were two, uh, so there were temporary waterfalls. There was one that was formed. I'm trying to find. I've got my notes here. Hang on, just 1 second.
Not a problem.
Yeah, one was a half mile above New Madrid, and one was 8 miles below New Madrid. Now, these both disappeared very quickly. You're talking about a massive volume of water with the Mississippi, so they weren't there for very long. Now, the river running backwards, that fault. So there was a gentleman named Myron Fuller. He wrote the first report about these earthquakes. He didn't do it until 1912. So he thought that the river running backwards, all the reports of that were a case of mass hysteria, right? That fault that splits the river that I mentioned that basically runs south-southeast over towards Realfoot, it is what's known as a reverse fault characterized by uplift. Mm-hmm. So it was on that fault on February 7th, 1812, you had uplift. So if you lift up that river channel, they think it created kind of a tsunami within the river, right?
Yeah.
And it was just south of New Madrid. So this tsunami would have kind of gone both ways too, right? But if you're down in Memphis, the water's coming at you fast, but from the appropriate direction. If you're in New Madrid, that water's actually coming at you from the wrong way. Also, south of us, at the bottom of that light bulb, right, just to our east, you know what I'm talking about, at the bottom of the bend there, crack developed, like I told you about Realfoot Lake, which would have exacerbated that effect. And then you would have had sort of a sloshing going on too, which would have kind of made that river look like it was doing something really funky on February 7th, 1812. So yeah, they think something like that kind of happened. Another one, church bells in Boston, right? We've heard that, right?
Yeah. And we talked about that. Yeah. Being the confusion.
Church bells in Boston. Yes.
Yes.
They think the legend is that church bells rang in Boston from these earthquakes. That probably didn't happen. They have never found any journals or broadsheets or, you know, public.
Yeah, they didn't have iPhones back then.
Talking about shaking in Boston. Yeah, there's no record of it anywhere. Charleston, Virginia, which is now Charleston, West Virginia, did have church bells ring. There is a section of Boston known as Charlestown. They think those two were sort of transposed as the story was retold over the years.
I mean, quite possibly, yeah.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. It feels logical, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sounds logical, sure.
That's crazy, man.
Yeah, that could happen. But yeah, we get things wrong all the time.
Yeah, but it makes for a good story anyway, right?
Yeah, it does, man. You know.
It sure does.
So who cares?
It sure does. That's why Charlestown became Boston, right? Because the story needed to get a little bigger.
Yeah, you know, it's good for...
I was actually just at a convention-type earthquake summit north of here about a month and a half ago. What happened after the earthquakes, there was some gentleman who said these earthquakes were caused by a volcano that had erupted in North Carolina. And that story got spread all to newspapers all over the country. And it was massively fraud. It was fraudulent. It was a fake story. It was just nobody made it up. So all these editors, once they found out that they had been lied
to, they'd been duped,
they quit publishing anything about the New Madrid earthquakes anymore. Oh, they thought it was all lies. Yeah. So that's a good one.
That's a shame.
I got that from a gentleman named Kent Moran. He's the he runs what's called the Center for Earthquake Research and Information. Well, he doesn't run it. He's the historian for the Center for Earthquake Research and Information at the University of Memphis, who studied this probably as much as anyone, I would imagine.
I wonder how many. I know there's shifts, and I can't really be sure all the ones in like Louisiana, but there were shifts in the river because of that quake. Wasn't that true? Up and down, made different channels. They took a different route in a couple spots. Was that caused?
I have not heard a lot of that. That is entirely possible, though. I have not heard any of those anecdotal stories. I know there was a pirate island, right? Where pirates. Yeah, I love that there were pirates on the Mississippi River. but there were pirates. There were pirates on the Mississippi River, and they stayed at an island and. This island actually disappeared, so with X number of pirates also disappearing. So that's always kind of an interesting story. Again, that may be an apocryphal tale. I'm not 100% certain. The first steamboat to ever sail on the Mississippi River was actually just south of New Madrid when the earthquakes hit. It's called the New Orleans, actually. It had sailed from Pittsburgh, so it was, you know, getting close to being done. And then it runs into this giant earthquake. But it did ultimately end up making it down to New Orleans.
Nice.
Good deal. Yeah, I kind of wonder how many eddies or whatever it was caused by by that, you know, for river traffic. And you have to imagine that river traffic probably was, you know, a lot busier because, I mean, that was the main mode of...
Back then, yeah, maybe, but...
Transportation with just simple fishermen, boats, people doing trade up and down the river.
There were reports of a lot of, like, flat boats that were just came floating down the river. And they don't know if those people made it to the banks or if they were fatalities. So that's why there's really, you don't see very many fatality estimates. They figure most of them occurred on or near the river. But they're just impossible to know. So you don't see too many estimates. Would you like to hear a firsthand account of there was actually a scientist who was sailing on the Mississippi, a British naturalist, who was sailing during the earthquakes. And it's pretty good, actually. You want to hear
this?
Sure,
absolutely.
Yeah, give it to us.
Okay, so after supper, we went to sleep as usual, about 10 o'clock. And in the night, I was awakened by the most tremendous noise, accompanied by an agitation of the boat so violent that it appeared in danger of upsetting. I could distinctly see the river as if agitated by a storm, and all the noise was inconceivably loud and terrific. I could distinctly hear the crash of falling trees and the screaming of wild fowl on the river, but found that the boat was still safe at her moorings. By the time we could get to our fire, which was on a large flag in the stern of the boat, the shock had ceased, but immediately the perpendicular banks both above and below us began to fall into the river in such vast masses as nearly to sink our boat by the swell they occasioned. At daylight, we had counted 27 shocks.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that something? That's a great quote. In terms of fatalities, I'm really just not sure. There were the banks caving in could have caused a number of those fatalities, though. Now they said that you had a huge area that would have almost like some areas like half acre fell into the river. They think that's probably an exaggeration. But you'll see numbers up to that.
So. Yeah, I could believe that, though.
Yeah, because the river there is a lot. You have a lot more bluffs.
Yeah, and you got it's sandy, and maybe some clay. You know,
yeah.
There's some clay problem, and clay's heavy.
Yeah.
So when clay hits the water, it's probably pretty heavy.
Well, where we're flat, like down if you go anywhere in Louisiana, yeah. Where the rivers, of course, with the levees there, but that's bluffed a lot of area over there, isn't it? Jeff,
we're real flat right here. You got some bluffs over as you get over towards Memphis, but no, right here, man, it is super flat. It's incredibly flat. If you're running south on I-55, like Cape Girardeau, and then you'll go down a hill near Benton, Missouri, and then it is basically flat on I-55 all the way to New Orleans.
Wow. Yeah, I thought so.
This is what's known as the Mississippi Embayment. I think it was an ancient ocean that was here.
Yeah.
That's why it's flat. And that's where the sand from the sand blows comes from.
Okay. That makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, it spits up.
Geology is pretty logical. That's why it's kind of fun, right?
Yeah, there's not a lot of production out that way for oil and gas. In Indiana and
no,
Illinois, there's a little
none.
Bit more. But not in Missouri, there's not really anything.
It was this,
no, they don't do any of that. No,
yeah.
The sand blows, they're caused by, isn't that right? Is it like almost like friction? It's not magma, but it's friction of the when the earth is, you know, when the two edges.
It's called liquefaction.
Right.
So that sandy soil, it shakes very violently. It takes on the properties of the liquid. Also here, the groundwater is shallow, right? So
yeah, that's what it's pulling. It's pulling in the water.
And then basically becomes almost quicksandy.
Yeah,
kind of the way I think of it. And so some of those sand blows would have just sort of, some of them erupted. Others were sort of a slow percolation. You'll hear them called sand geysers or sand volcanoes. I have never personally seen one erupt or anything like that, but there were reports that they erupted up to 100 feet in the air during the earthquakes.
Wow, that's cool.
Again, unverified, right?
So, yeah.
Yeah, but, and then I think that was on the Missouri and the Tennessee side had that as well, I believe.
And Illinois, you would have
yeah,
seen that.
I would probably
a lot of
imagine
places.
So. Yeah.
Yeah.
Arkansas, for sure. Yep, yep.
Well, you have the Wabash seismic zone as well?
Yes.
So
yes,
that's
the Wabash. No, a lot of people don't know about the Wabash River Valley seismic zone. Yes, I call them our cousins in the
Northeast. That extends up to the Northeast.
It basically runs the Indiana-Illinois border. I don't think it includes the Wabash as it turns in state. You know, it moves kind of north and east as you're going upstream. And actually, the largest earthquake in this part of the country in the last, like, 20 years or so was on the Wabash in 2008.
Yeah, y'all got a pretty good area out there.
5.4 magnitude.
Wow.
5.4, Mount Carmel, Illinois was the epicenter there. So.
Wow. Oof. Yeah, it looks pretty hot up there from the maps I've looked at.
Southern Illinois is kind of a convergence zone. It's like all the seismic zones. It's really interesting. Also, two major rivers, so...
Yeah. Yeah,
it's very, very interesting. Feels like the damage kind of follows these river channels, too, if you look at, like, damage maps. There's also, you can see damage, you can find damage maps from the last 6-magnitude quake around here, which was in 1895.
Wow.
And they kind of just follow the river up the Missouri, up the Ohio, up the Mississippi. Obviously, they spread it inland, too, but there's these little spikes, it looks like, and that's what it feels like to be anyway. So,
now,
very, very interesting.
Now, did they have any, like, I know they always, like, on the, you know, on the West Coast and down towards South America, you know, they can tell when the pressure is building. Do they have any prediction why, you know, they would?
I mean, they kind of can, but not really.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, exactly. They can't really predict earthquakes, but they can measure sort of heat and pressure buildup, though. There's not seeing a lot of that here, to be quite honest with you. Like, they can measure these faults, like the two faults that run southwest and northeast are strike slip, and so they can, like, measure how far one side is moving relative to the other, and it's not much here, so we're encouraged by that. They give, so big earthquakes happened here prior to 1811 and 12 at about 1450, 900, 300 AD, and then 1000 and 2300 BC. I think they just found some stuff at about 10,000 BC, too. I'm not 100% certain on that.
From, like, cores?
Well, actually, interesting. I think the 1450 and 900 were, at least 1450 was from sand blows.
Okay.
They thought they were all originally from 1811 and 12, and then they started written in them and found organic material and dated it, and they're like, this is too old. So,
sometimes I guess they get that from core samples, but I guess there's different ways to measure that.
Believe they did some of that, too, over in Tennessee is where they got that 10,000 BC number. I more read article summaries than the actual articles. You know what I mean?
I do that.
Tell me what it says.
Oh yeah, I know you're talking about. You know, it's funny you said all that, because that was going to be my next question. Was, you know, because I know that they have a history of saying how long did this quake. Like, my youngest moved up to the Pacific Northwest, and I was telling her about the Cascadia quake of 1800.
Yeah,
no,
up there, the faults are moving quite a bit more, and a lot more creep.
Yeah, they've
got
a lot more problems up there. That's for sure.
You can actually measure the creep, you know, by year, and it's quite a bit of difference, you know.
Okay,
that's the way. Yeah, that is also. So we are on an intraplate fault system, right? We are not where two tectonic plates converge. That's where 90% of your earthquakes on the planet happen in a given year. They call them subduction zones. West Coast of South America, West Coast of the United States,
they go like this.
Alaska, basically all of the coast of Alaska. Mm-hmm.
And they get
the Ring of Fire.
So you're saying
Northern India.
And they get megathrust quakes and thrust quakes, whereas you're saying the quakes in Mississippi River area are called
those strike faults, strike.
Well,
slip faults.
I think they're the same names. They're just
They're going like
different. Different properties.
Yeah, they're different. The way they respond.
Well, see, that's why I was thinking the way he's doing his hands and rubbing them together, and that's why I would think that you'd get the liquefaction because of the friction. Is that correct?
Well, it's the vibration of the earth.
That is for more from your vibrations from the earthquakes themselves.
Okay.
So these intraplate faults, because we're in the middle here of a tectonic plate continent, the bedrock is more dense and there's far less fracturing because you don't have two giant plates of the Earth's crust slamming into one another. So shockwaves here travel much further than they do from earthquakes on subduction zones, up to 20 times as far. And that's the same for, like, that New Jersey earthquake that hit, well, like a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
And then like that earthquake that hit Virginia, it was like 2011, I believe. Because the eastern boundary of the North American plate is in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, like roughly where Iceland is, you know. Iceland actually sits on top of and is being of the North American and Eurasian plates. You can mm-hmm. actually go to Iceland and stand in between them where right. there aren't volcanoes. I would recommend right. going there.
Yeah, that whole...
that would be very cool.
That whole mid-cut through the Atlantic is... It's like a...
Yeah, the mid-Atlantic Ridge. Yeah, yep, so that's the boundary.
That's hot.
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's constantly moving.
Yep. Yeah.
Constantly changing, yeah.
But it's in the middle of nowhere, so it doesn't, you know, it's not like the Pacific
yes,
where everybody lives
growing,
on.
Growing, right? So, so we're moving apart
growing.
From Europe, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we'll
so
notice it in about another
stuff.
30 million years.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right.
Right.
Yeah, that's exactly right. North America, the North American plate is moving to the southwest, which is ultimately the responsible for the earthquakes here, right? The entire movement of the whole plate kind of messes with this soft spot, this weak spot, right? Moving an inch, 25 millimeters per year to the southwest. So I like telling kids that.
Yeah, I was surprised to learn how few major earthquakes there were or there have been in the northeast kind of eastern coastline. I believe it says only like 20 since 1800.
I haven't even looked that up. I know Charleston, South Carolina is another real, like if you look on those earthquake hazard maps, the USGS puts out, like around Charleston's another one. They had mid to high sevens and it was in the late 19th century. I want to say 1880s. I could be wrong.
Versus East Coast.
But they have very powerful earthquakes.
Lot.
Yes. Another thing about these intraplate fault systems, so it appears they go through waking and sleeping phases, right? And so there's people out there, not many, let's say 5 to 10% of geologists, seismologists say, this might be going to sleep here.
Yeah.
I don't think it is. I don't think there's any way to actually prove that.
Right, yeah.
But
I don't think so either.
That discussion is happening as well, too. Yeah. So, And I just... You know, mostly I run a museum and I want to tell people about earthquakes and like how they happen and why they happen.
Yeah,
then some people are, you know, digged, right? And so I have to know more. And then so that's kind of.
So when did y'all open the museum?
The museum opened in 1975, actually.
Wow.
Opened kind of a couple ladies got the idea. We're private. We get no funding.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to start a museum and they said it was kind of grandma's attic at the beginning. They got a few pieces from sort of some arrowheads and some points and things of that nature and some Civil War bullets. And then there's some World War II, like Purple Hearts. They said, but all anyone from out of town wanted to talk about was earthquakes. And we didn't know anything about earthquakes.
That's what I did.
So they had to. Well, and we actually, our earthquake exhibit is pretty nice, Doug, if you could attest to that. We actually got a grant for that, a matching grant. And,
cool.
Had that professionally built, designed, installed about a dozen years ago.
So. Yeah, it's a lot deeper than what I had seen before.
So what is it?
I mean, they have...
It's basically panels. Like, I've got a giant map of the New Madrid seismic zone with seismicity mapped out over about a 30-year period, which kind of does a good job of resolving the faults. Like a giant pictures of sand blows and sand boils, historical and modern. Got a world map that shows you all the different tectonic plates. I mean, this thing is like 8x10. The different tectonic plates, the Earth's crust is divided into, and like the direction and speed they're moving at, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, that's cool.
Got some touch screens. You can sort of explore some questions about the New Madrid earthquakes. I've got a flat screen that's showing real-time earthquakes worldwide. And then we have a little table where you can try to build an earthquake-proof building.
So that's cool.
That's good.
Yeah.
And I have an oscilloscope, too.
So who are the demographics that visit your museum mostly?
Mostly? Well, I would say we tend to skew older. I think most museums do, you know, especially small-town museums.
Not a lot of field trips?
6,000 people a year.
Like children?
Get some. It's hard to get field trips these days, I think. Like, I've got three coming in May. You know, they'll tend to do them in May, maybe late fall. And I'm kind of small. Like, I can do about, if you're bigger than 50, I'm going to have to split you into two groups, which isn't a real big problem. but it can add to create some challenges. We get those. I get a lot of some tour buses. I get a lot of folks that show up that way. We get riverboats. Riverboats stop at New Madrid, actually. So we're kind of an excursion site, right? I kind of joke we're the Mississippi River of Cozumel, right?
There you go. History, man. Come on now.
Yeah. No Carlos and Charlie's, but yeah, we, you know.
Yeah.
The company we've done the most business with just filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, though, back in February, which was a bummer. So yeah. I don't have any of those scheduled. But we do, you know, I'm open daily, like 7 days a week. Wow. We're open about 355 days a year.
Wow.
So if you come by here, we're going to be here. Yeah, I'm closed. The next day at this museum will be closed is Thanksgiving. So,
wow.
That's incredible.
Then we're closed. We were closed the Friday. The two ladies who founded the museum, that was kind of their mission, was that we have to be here every day, right? In small-town museums, there's a lot of them. You go, there's a little sign. Call me here. I'll be there in 10 minutes. Or we're open Tuesday to Thursday, noon to 3. And they didn't think that was the right way to operate a museum. So,
yeah.
It created its own set of challenges because you can't get volunteers to work like 3,000 hours a year or whatever.
Yeah, right.
And it's, you know, I mean,
so we're employed. Yeah. So I'm employed.
Okay, good.
I've got a part timer. Yes. We get paid to do this.
Nice.
We ain't getting rich, but we get paid.
Well, that's still good. So it's good.
Yeah. You know, and it just
sounds like you're enjoying it too.
I'm
in my 50s. Yeah. This is kind of a retirement job for me. It's a lot of fun. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And you get off the road a little bit and you pop and you see these type of places. I mean, that's why I always talk about loving road trips. And there's so much history along the Mississippi River, and especially in Missouri too. You know, you think of Mark Twain and everything else, Hannibal and all that up there, you know. So it's a lot of history. And
the Mississippi had a lot going on.
Yeah. And
up by Kansas City, there's a World War One museum that's very nice too. St. Louis has some good attractions. Don't forget Cahokia Mounds, guys. That's actually UNESCO World Heritage Site. The Mississippians or mound builders. Cahokia was kind of...
Right.
There's center ritual location. It's in Metro St. Louis area on the Illinois side. Mm-hmm. Well worth a visit. The largest earthen mound in North America is there. It is called Monk's Mound. Monk's Mound because some monks lived near it, actually. Mm-hmm. But it's 100 feet tall. They think it was probably taller. It's probably eroded some. But it's 15 acres at its base, so it has a larger surface area than the Great Pyramid.
Right. I've heard about that, yeah. I've never been there, but yeah.
Jeff, do you have any websites or pages that you want to direct our listeners to?
NewMadridMuseum.com. NewMadridMuseum.com is my museum. We've got a contact us. You can find my Google page. You can find the TripAdvisor, my Facebook page. Our hours are accurate and all that stuff. So you'll always be able to find us or get in touch with us. I'm not the most social media savvy person in the world, but I promise if you call and leave a message on my old-fashioned answering machine, I'll call you back.
Nice.
They are friendly.
I've been
people.
Able to become a bit of a Luddite living in a small town. I haven't been able to kind of eschew sort of some technology, although I do still look at my fantasy baseball team on my phone too much.
There's nothing wrong with that, man. Would you have...
No, there isn't. No, there isn't.
Thanks so much for joining us today, man.
Hey, it was great. I hope this worked for you gentlemen. Rob, Doug, this has been a lot of fun.
Great.
It's called the Nonsense Chronicles. Please send me a link or something. I can put it on the museum's Facebook page. We do have a Facebook page. I'm not the world's most social media savvy person, but I'll share that. So
we'll get it out to you. And please, everybody, go visit the new Madrid Historical Museum. So much information, including a ton of good stuff on that 1811, 1812 quake. It's the Nonsense Chronicles, and we will talk to you again soon.
Yay. Later.